One of my favorite things is when a hacker will find, like, go through a company's like documentation or like support portal, and they'll be like, docs and how to use the application. And it'll have some video of like an education person, you know, using the application in a certain way. Like maybe there's a video, like a tutorial on the company's doc site to like, here's how to use XYZ feature. And it might like have a, like an API key, like in the video. And if they were using like an actual like production organization and didn't rotate that key, like I've seen hackers use videos or like screenshots in documentation to gain access to things because whoever was like writing the docs, you know, they're typically not like super like security thoughtful people. They're just writing docs to make their users have a better experience learning the application. But, you know, they're not thinking, okay, who is actually watching this? Who is seeing this? And what am I actually showing?
Welcome to Software Snack Bites. I'm your host, Shomik Ghosh of Bold Start Ventures, and today we're excited to have Douglas Day on the show. Douglas is one of the top grossing hackers on the HackerOne platform, as you can see from the hat he's wearing, and he's also a senior security engineer at Elastic. And so in this episode, we're going to cover, you know, frankly, all things hacking and all the interesting things that are going on there. So I guess, Douglas, just to start off, can you give the audience a sense of your background and sort of how you got even to this place where you're doing this sort of ethical hacking?
Yeah. Well, first, thanks for having me on, Shomik. Super honored to be here. So my journey into hacking started 2019, so just over 5 years ago, going on 6 years. This was 2018. Yeah, so 6 years ago. I had just started an application security engineer job at a company called New Relic. I worked there for almost 2 years. But when I joined, I'd never heard of bug bounties, never really heard of hacking in the bug bounty sense. However, part of our duties on the application security team was running a bug bounty program. And so I joined the New Relic security team, started looking at these reports that were coming in, and I was amazed that the reports we were getting were so simple to reproduce. And these were live bugs on an actual application that millions of users were using. You know, because previously you see like cross-site scripting, you're like, okay, you know, it might be vulnerable in some lab environment, but these aren't bugs that are actually seen in the wild. But no, like we were having hackers reach out to us with these like cross-site scripting vulnerabilities or these ways to modify other users' data. And it was just like really, really simple proof of concepts. And I was like reproducing these to send them to the developers. And I was like, man, I bet I could do this. And so around that time, you know, my wife and I, we were looking to start our family. And we were living in a tiny apartment at the time. We thought we should buy a house because we wanted to grow our family. And we're looking at the house prices. I'm like, these are spendy. Maybe I should like do some like consulting work on the side to pick up some, you know, extra income to build up a down payment. But then after looking at these bug bounty reports that we were getting, I was like, oh, you know, maybe I could do this. And so it was October of 2018. I went to B-Sides Portland. B-Sides PDX. And one of the engineers, I don't remember if he was working at HackerOne at the time, but it was a guy, Ben Siddiqapour. He worked at HackerOne for some amount of time, gave a talk on doing bug bounties. And I was like, wow, okay, this must be like a divine sign. I was looking at a way to bring in some extra income. So this guy comes and talks about bug bounties on HackerOne, and I made my account that night, right? And so, I think that was October 21st or 22nd or something of 2018. And then I started looking at different programs to hack on. Saw a couple of interesting looking programs, eventually settled on Coinbase and found a pretty like low severity issue on the Coinbase bug bounty program, but submitted that. And then in December, so about two months after I started, I got my very first $200 bounty. And wow, like having never gotten a bounty before, getting that first $200
felt pretty good.
Ping, it was awesome. It was awesome. And then I got hooked ever since. And so, you know, I started doing this, I started hacking more, started making more. And eventually it was 2019, in August of 2019, I got my very first invite to a live hacking event. Now, I had never heard of these, didn't know what they were. But it's like, okay, it looks like HackerOne's going to be in Vegas for DEF CON, and they're running this live hacking event on like Yahoo and GitHub, and then one other private customer. And it was, find as many bugs as you can. We're going to pay you extra bounties for the bugs you find. And I had moderate success there, but I met a couple of hackers. Like, I started networking, found some really prolific hackers, like sat down with the number one grossing hacker on HackerOne, Today Is New, and another hacker named Hogarth45. And then a couple months later, they invited me as their plus one invites to the HackerOne event in Los Angeles in November of 2019. And we totally like kicked it, you know, killed it there in Los Angeles. And then I've gotten invited to almost every live event since. And now here I am, having just gotten back from Miami for my 16th live event. So started out small, and then, yeah.
Yeah, it grew from there. But I want to actually talk to you about that that Miami event, because I think you won a special award there, which was the MVH, the Most Valuable Hacker Award from HackerOne. So,
yes.
You know, kind of, what does that mean? How'd that come about? Like, you know, tell us more about that.
Yeah, so with these live events, they like to issue awards. You know, you get your bounties, and that's all fine. You know, money is money. It's awesome. But what really draws the hackers there are these, like, special awards. You know, these trophy. I've got a couple of them on my wall back there. And there's a number of them that they award. There's, I think, like, the exterminator for the hacker that finds the most impactful bug. There's the first place in bounties, second place in bounties. There's, I think it's called the eradicator for the hacker that finds the most impactful bug on the day of the event. But anyhow, that's all gravy compared to the, like, creme de la creme of hacker awards, which is the MVH, or the most valuable hacker. And it's this belt. It's this, like, leather belt, like a WWE belt that they award. And it goes to the best hacker overall, like the hacker who is consistently reporting critical vulnerabilities or high vulnerabilities, was a pleasure to work with, and just delivered the customer the best hacking experience. Prior to this, I had been to 15 live events and never won an MVH. And I was beginning to start, I was starting to really doubt myself. But this, at this event in Miami with Capital One as the customer, the stars aligned. I decided to go solo for the very first time, because typically I'll team up with other hackers and we'll, like, work as a team. But I decided, you know what, this time I'm just going to see how I can do for myself. I'm going to, you know, kind of go outside of my comfort zone, put on my big boy pants, and just, you know, go hard. And I was at the end of my parental leave, having just had a baby in October. And I'm like, you know what, these final two weeks of parental leave, I'm just going to give it my everything. I'm going to treat hacking like it's my full-time job, and I'm just going to go hard on this, on Capital One. And ended up finding a number of really cool vulnerabilities that were just beautiful in their creativity. And the Capital One team loved it. And at the end of the event, we're sitting there in I think it was called a Pink Taco, this restaurant in Miami Beach. And they announced the awards, and I got the MVH, and I started tearing up, because it was like 16 live event, 5 years in the making. It was very much like a homecoming experience.
That's awesome, especially coming off of parental leave too. So double congrats to you on multiple.
Yeah, thank you.
Multiple fronts. But I guess one thing I want to kind of ask about here is, like, you're talking about bug bounties, and you're even talking about, like, working together as a team with other hackers and stuff like that. Like, just, I guess, explain, like, what a bug bounty program is, how it differs from, like, pen testing or red teaming, and even this, like, team concept. Like, how do you pick a team? Like, is this like a common thing? Like, what, you know, kind of talk more about it.
Yeah. No, great questions. So I think a lot of your listeners, especially those who work in the tech industry, are going to be familiar with the concept of a red team engagement, you know, where you'll hire some pen testers, some security experts to come and spend X amount of hours to try to, breach their system, gain as access to as many things as possible. And then at the end of that time allotment, they say, okay, here's how far we got. Here's our findings. And that's fine. And I think that's really effective. But what a complaint I've heard about those is that because they are time, because it's just paid by the hour, you don't really have any way to know if a, like, specific application that you built is vulnerable, right? You just know, okay, did the hackers get in, or did they not get in? They spent this number of hours. I don't know if how, like, deep their coverage was. I don't know if they spent all their time on a, like, just a one specific website and that's how they got in, or if they tested this app, and you know, and this. Whereas with a bug bounty program, the goal is to identify very specific applications that you want to know if they're vulnerable. Like typically this will be like a SaaS company, and they'll have their main SaaS app and they'll want to know, okay, yeah, sure, you know, you may be able to like use phishing to like gain access to things, you know, whatever. We've got red team engagements to suss that out. You may be able to like, yeah, do like smishing or some other thing. But what we really want to know is the application that we're building for our customers, is it vulnerable? And are we putting our customers at risk if they use our application? And so with a bug bounty, we'll say, okay, here's the target. Tell us, you find as many things as you can. You don't necessarily try to take it all the way, but just figure out, okay, is there a cross-site scripting on the PDF renderer? Is there a way for me to make modifications to other users? Is there a way for me to leak PII using this application that's in scope? And so with a bug bounty engagement, you are only paying for the vulnerabilities that are actually found. So if you have a very secure app and hackers aren't able to actually find anything, then you're not going to be paying a lot. And you know, it's all the better for you. You've got a secure application and you don't have to pay that much. Whereas if you have a very vulnerable application, you're going to be paying a lot of bounties, but they're also going to be delivering a lot of value. And so with a bug bounty program, you are kind of guaranteeing that you are getting value out of the money that you spend, because you're only paying for things that actually are vulnerable.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. You know, you have a day job as a security engineer, right? And I guess my question is actually, as you're doing these bug bounties, Do you find yourself taking things that you learn from hacking an application and finding a vulnerability or weak point? Do you often find yourselves kind of being like, huh, you know what? Tomorrow I can go and apply that in my day job, actually. Or is that not really as relevant?
I'd say, so it depends on the type of security engineering you do. When I worked in application security, when I worked at New Relic, and my first job when I joined Elastic was on the product security team, I think that knowledge was a lot more applicable. You know, I'd see hackers hacking us that were fighting a bunch of subdomain takeovers that we were vulnerable to. And I could say, okay, let's go and take what the hackers are doing and try to apply the same methodologies internally. Or I might learn something while I'm hacking about like a new attack. Like, okay, it looks like I found this tool that can find vulnerable GitHub workflows to be able to like take over some target's supply chain. I want to take that knowledge. I'm going to hack us internally. So yes, I'd say initially when I was working in product security or AppSec, totally a lot of crossover. My current role is a lot more DevSecOps focused. And so I'm working a lot with like infrastructure and running the infrastructure around our SIM. And so I'd say I have less crossover these days.
That makes sense. You mentioned actually a GitHub, you know, that tool for the GitHub exploits or whatever mm-hmm. you said. And I guess the question I have around that is, how many of these tools are available? Like, I mean, if I were to just go online and we're like, hey, I want to, I don't know, mm-hmm. just fish somebody or send a smishing thing, right? Like, can I just find a tool online that I could just use?
Totally. Yeah. So there's even companies that like their product are these tools that hackers use with the goal that companies are also using them to protect themselves. So like, I think Project Discovery is a really cool company. They've got a number of tools that hackers use for like recon to find vulnerable subdomains, to look for, to do asset discovery, to find where an attacker might find an entryway. And yeah, they sell to companies who are looking to use those same tools internally to be able to beat the attackers to the punch. So yeah. And there's also a bunch of open source tools. You can just find them all over GitHub. A really popular one that I use is like Sublister.
Okay, so these are open source on GitHub, right? Like, mm-hmm. shouldn't someone be trying to take them down? Like, this seems kind of crazy to just like leave these tools hanging out there that anybody can use.
So I think that at the trend that we are moving towards in this like decade in security is the realizing that bad hackers are going to have these tools anyways. They're going to be writing them, and the more people that have access to them are the better, because companies are going to be able to employ security engineers or external bug bounty hunters to be able to use them to find the vulnerabilities before the bad actors do. And so it's kind of an assumption that bad actors and, you know, black hat hackers are going to be already have access to these tools. If they don't, they're going to write their own. And so we want to lower the bar to entry to be able to find vulnerabilities as much as possible, because the more white hat hackers or security researchers we have trying to help companies out, the more secure that company is going to be.
Got it. Okay. That makes a lot of sense in terms of the mindset. The one final question I have to ask you, just in terms of kind of this whole ethical hacking sort of approach, is is it hard for you to flip from defensive posture to attacking posture? Like, is that a weird thing to all of a sudden be like, oh, now I'm on the, you know, now I'm like trying to be aggressive and do this, and then, you know, the other side, oh, I'm trying to, you know, protect against all these things?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'd say so. I don't have a hard time going from defense to offense, because I love the offensive side. Like, when I'm playing defense, I always wish I were playing offense, and I kind of like, that's where I just naturally like gravitate towards. It is harder for me to have to go from the fun of being like on an offensive engagement and, you know, trying to evade the detection teams to switching and being on a more defensive, calmer role. So I'd say yes, it's hard in one way. No, it's hard, not hard in the other way. You did ask a question a few minutes ago that I realized I didn't answer. And so if I may go back and talk about what it's like to build a team or to work in a team on bug bounty. I think the bug bounty community is a very tightly knit community. We all know each other. We meet each other at these competitions or conferences, and we all like to see each other succeed. And so when it comes to hacking a new target, like I love collaborating. In fact, I think I've won 9 best collaboration awards on the HackerOne platform. So like most of these trophies on the wall are for best collaboration. And so I just like to work with people that I know and that I've had a good experience with. And you know, when you're working with the hackers that are at the, you know, the top, you know, whatever percent of the bug bounty community, and they're going to these live events to hack on massive targets like GitHub or like Capital One or Yahoo, these are hackers who really know their stuff. And so you're not really concerned about them not pulling their weight. You just know that they know things that you don't know, you know, things that they don't know. And it's just so much more fun to hop on like a Discord call or a Zoom call or whatever, and with someone who's, you know, across the world, and be like, okay, let's hack on this this application together and work as if we're coworkers. And at times my hacking friends that I'm working on a team with, they feel just as much like coworkers as my day job coworkers do, you know, because we're working towards the same goal. We both want to find bugs, we both want to make money, and we can just make each other better hackers in the process. So it's, I think to answer your question, the community within bug bounty is so good that it's really, really easy to find a team to work with, because you're less worried about the money that you make and more about just learning from each other.
That's really cool. And makes a lot of sense. Let's dive into the hacking side. And
yeah.
Where I want to start is, I think the question that everybody has, you see a bug bounty, like let's just say, hey, bug bounty for this, I'm using, you know, Capital One, like scenario, like for this user facing banking application, mm-hmm. right? So I guess like, where do you start? And what I'm even curious about is like, you know, it could be a browser based application. It could be, in JavaScript. It could be something, a completely different language, right? Like there's all sorts of different ways to approach. Like, do you use a certain library to get in? Do you try and attack the database? Like, you know, so
yeah.
Just how do you go about doing this? Like, it just seems very strange to figure out that entry point.
So the beauty about bug bounty is that there's literally thousands of different programs to hack on. And so every hacker knows their skill set. Some hackers are very recon focused, and they'll see a bug bounty program open up that's like, everything that we own is in scope. Just find bugs, and we will pay for them. Whereas you might have another application or another bug bounty program where they're like, we only care about this one application, but it's freaking huge, right? There's a bunch of different functionality. We're releasing new features all the time. We've got things in beta. We've got things in alpha. We can get you access to those alpha features or those beta features. We just want to know, like, but we only want to know about this one specific product, but we want you to go deep. And so knowing your skill set helps a lot there. Like if I see a program that opens up that's more wide than deep, then I'm going to be less interested in it. I really like biting my teeth into a really complicated heavy tech stack where there might be features that haven't been updated in like 4 or 5 years because it's just so esoteric and strange. And so for me, if you're asking me the question, I'll say if a new bug bounty program opens up, first I'm going to look to see if it matches my skill set and if it actually interests me. I don't do a lot of mobile hacking. And so if it's a primarily mobile application, like
the banking app or whatever.
Yeah. I'm probably not going to spend time on it. And I'm going to just move to something that does match my skill set. Whereas if it's something that's very deep and technical and web-based, then that I'm going to say, okay, that's going to be where I'm going to start. That's going to be something I'm going to hack on. And then once I've decided I'm going to hack on that application, the number one thing, I think I've talked about this in a previous talk, but the number one thing that I'm going to be looking for is access control, because that's kind of my bread and butter. I love, love, love applications that have various levels of permissions where, you know, maybe, you know, an attacker might not be able to leak everybody's PII, but maybe I can find vulnerabilities where this read-only user is able to do this functionality that only a high-level user is able to do. And you know, that's still a bug, right? If I can go in as a super low-level user, but then modify other users in my org's email addresses, you know, that's super impactful. Or I'm going to start looking for, especially if it's a SaaS app and it's like multi-tenant, I'll look for ways if I can like take my organization's users and then modify data or retrieve data from other tenants. And that's very, very common in SaaS applications, especially ones that are self-signup. I really love self-signup applications where you can make your own organization, sign up as an administrator, have administrator rights, and then try to perform administrator actions on other organizations. Because, there's the amount of attack vectors there is limitless. In fact, this was a couple years ago, like 4 or 5 years ago now, saw a brand new bug bounty program open up, or it was a private one, so I got invited to it. And within 30 minutes, I was able to find a way to modify any other user's passwords, like to basically log into any user's account. And the way it worked was because it was a self-sign-up application that was multi-tenant. And so what you could do is when you signed up for this application, you were made an administrator of your organization, right? It makes you an org, makes you the administrator, and then it's pretty standard. You can invite users to your organization, and give them various levels of permissions. And one other thing you could do as the administrator was modify the users in your org's email addresses. Now it still sounds pretty normal, yep. But where the bug was that you could. It was an application such that you could exist in multiple organizations at once. And so if you, Shomik, had your own organization and I had my organization and I wanted to take over your entire organization, all I needed to do was set up my own organization for free because it was a free trial application.
Yep.
Using your email, invite you to my org because you can exist in multiple organizations at once, right? You exist in your org and now you also exist in my org. But because I'm the administrator of my org, I can then change your email address to something I control, then go through the reset password workflow.
Oh, and then go to
and then access your entire organization.
No way.
Yeah. So using found this within 30 minutes of it opening, and so you could effectively just knowing people's email addresses, you could take over literally any user's organization on the entire application. And this was a production bug, and it took me 25 minutes to find. And so to answer your question, the very first thing I look for is in what ways does this application let me modify users or have various levels of users, whether they're administrator users or read-only users, those complex role-based access control schemas. So that's how I work. That's not how every hacker works. Some go super wide, just find things with automation, but that's kind of what I do.
So lots of questions around that. I guess as an admin, you'd want to give the privileges of if someone puts in a wrong email or something, yeah. Then you'd want to be able to go in and correct. Why does the admin have that access? Because it seems kind of strange that I wouldn't want someone changing my email, but I guess in the case that there's an error, right, you need to help them fix it or?
Yeah, I'd say so. Most applications don't let an admin change their users' email addresses. So that's kind of one of the flaws. The other big flaw was that it didn't require accepting an invitation when I invited someone to my organization. Like, what should have happened is I should have invited you to my org, and then it would have sent you an email. It's like, Douglas Day invites you to his organization. Click here to accept or ignore this email if you don't know this person. But it didn't, right? It just, I sent the invite and it added you to my org right away. And so that was kind of the linchpin as to why it was really impactful.
Okay.
Because otherwise, if it required you like intentionally joining my organization after I sent an invite, it would have still been a security bug, but I think it would not have been nearly as scary or cool.
Okay. So now a couple questions on which are harder and easier. So something like Google Auth. I mean, I use it all the time, right? Like, is that fairly challenging to be able to figure out how, or is it all the same of, hey, Google Auth is not the point. The auth point isn't, it's like all the privileges and escalations and stuff you can do once you're signed in.
Yeah, it depends on the hacker. I've known a couple of hackers who find a lot of like ways that Google Auth is misconfigured. So it's not like Google Auth is insecure. I think there's ways that you can implement it poorly.
Okay.
I am not technically knowledgeable on like what those ways are, so I don't really spend much time hacking like Google Auth workflows. But that's not to say there aren't vulnerabilities there, because I've worked with a number of hackers who just know the ways that various companies implement Google Auth poorly.
Okay. Now, in that same case that we were talking about, if multi-factor auth was turned on, mm-hmm. right, would that have exponentially made it harder, or do you think you still could have figured out a way or pretty quickly?
Yeah, so I guess that if multi-factor, if MFA was there, I think it would have been harder. I would have done a couple of things to try to bypass it. Like I like to say that MFA stands for, you know, mother freaking annoying, because it does get annoying when I encounter it as a hacker. However, there are also ways like to implement MFA poorly. Like for example, I've seen some applications where, yeah, it might bring you to the page where it asks you for your MFA code, but gave you a valid session before you got to that point. And so if you knew like the API calls that were being made, you could just, you know, take that auth token and then plug them into your like repeater and then still actually do things, even if your browser's page was asking for the MFA code. Or there may have been maybe in that particular application, the admin had the ability to turn off their users, MFA, because apparently the admin had the permission to change email. So why not give them permission to turn off MFA for a user? And so there's a number of ways I would have tried to like take it a step further to still bypass it. But yeah, it is very possible that my attack would have been stopped by MFA. But it just depends on the application.
Yeah. Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
When I listen to you talk about this, right, I would assume the hardest thing is first finding that entry point and the way that you would go about doing it. My question then is, when you get to that point where, you know, like you said, you're the admin, you kind of figured out this thing. Are you now like a kid in a candy store where you're just like, oh, escalation's like super easy and like I can just run a bunch of different tests and figure mm-hmm. it out? Or is it like, is it still at that point really difficult, even though you've gained so-called, you know, your entry point, your access point? Is it still pretty difficult to figure out like, okay, now what do I do?
Yeah. So I think it depends on the bug bounty program. Some programs are really awesome to work with, and you could tell them, okay, here, I found this, you know, I found this entry point so far. This is a bug. You know, go ahead and pay me for it, but I want to see how far I can take it. And they'll kind of like help you out or like guide you and be like, oh, you know, you gained access to here. You should try attacking this. Other programs are going to be kind of paranoid and skittish. And if you show them how far you've gotten, they'll try to quickly like patch it up, and you know, you'll effectively ruin your access. And so you kind of really have to know the program, and it helps if you have a history with them and know ahead of time. But because I don't like to potentially risk getting duped on somebody else's report, I'm the type of person where as soon as I find something, I'll report it and then just hope and ask that they'll let me continue trying to escalate. But it doesn't always happen. Sometimes they just shut it down, pay me for the initial find, and you know, I can't find potential future vulnerabilities. But you know, when you work with hundreds of different programs, you got to take the kisses with the bruises. So
you know, one thing that I've heard is just broadly, phishing is one of the most common attack points. Like you even talked about it, whether it's phishing, smishing, like all these sort of things are a common attack point. It sounds like maybe you don't use that as much yourself, but is it something that you're finding in general, like teams that you're working with and stuff are just like, hey, let's just figure out a way to phish an employee, because then boom, like the world will open up to us?
Yeah. So I'd say I do like phishing in the context of performing like a red team engagement. Like I kind of talked about the difference between bug bounty and red team. If I'm working with a client and doing like consulting work and they ask me to, you just try to like breach their system or to, and they give me permission to phish, then I will absolutely phish. But like I said, I was telling you before the call, that's like probably less than like 2% of the work that I do. In the context of bug bounty, that like 99.9% of programs will have phishing as out of scope, because they know that humans are the weakest connection, and they're not interested in finding out ways that you could like fish an employee. They're interested in how is our product vulnerable. That said, I have seen at least one or two bug bounty programs in the past which allowed for phishing, and it was a very interesting experience. I think a lot of hackers in that program maybe only tried to focus on phishing because it was allowed, and then left a lot of other stuff on the table. But yeah, to answer your question, in bug bounty, most of the time
it's out of scope.
Phishing is going to be out of scope.
Okay, that makes sense. The other thing I still want to talk about is like you're how do you still learn the access point? I mean, I guess like if you're doing the access flow, you kind of know what's happening, and so you can, that's repeatable each and every time, as you could just go and sign up and do it. But again, like let's say it is something like the sign-up flow is fairly secure.
It is.
You still want to learn what's going on with those, with the internal permissions and stuff like that. Like I guess, is there a way to know that just from looking at it from the outside and like observing it and poking here, poking there? Or do you just have to like get deep into the system and just start testing a bunch of different things?
So every single application is different. And I think I think I've had success because I treat every application as different. The same attack will not work on every single app or every single program. That said, as you do bug bounty, you kind of develop what I call a sniffer or a spidey sense. And you notice functionality that will typically be vulnerable to a very particular attack. And so, give you an example. When you are like using an API to modify like data, right? Like let's say there's an application that lets you like write documents in it, and you make a change to the document, and the backend API is like put /API/document/12345, and like that ID is just like an iteratable number, and then if you make another doc, it's /12346, and then another one it's 12347. You're like, that kind of like sets off alarm bells. It's like, okay, maybe this is vulnerable to what's called an IDOR, or insecure direct object reference, which are vulnerabilities where you just modify the ID to a document you don't have access to and see if it modifies somebody else's document. And so if I see IDs in like the API but are not what's called UUIDs, which are basically very long, unguessable strings, then my spidey sense goes off and I'm like, okay, I'm going to start looking for IDORs here. I'm gonna make two users of two like different organizations, grab the IDs from my victim organization, and then just like put them in every single request that's in my attacker organization, and see if my attacker org can affect the victim org at all. And I've made most of my bounties from these types of bugs, because they're just so common and so hard to protect against, because you have to protect against every single API endpoint. Like every single API endpoint you have has to validate, okay, is this object that is being retrieved or modified or deleted, does it actually belong to the user who's making the API call? And you know, sometimes it might validate that the user owns it with a put request, but if you change the put to a delete, suddenly the attacker is able to delete the other user's object. So yeah, to answer your question, you develop a spidey sense of where vulnerabilities likely are based on what you're seeing, and you kind of gain that as you just gain experience doing bug bounty, and you start noticing things like, oh, you know, that's a very interesting functionality that I've never seen before, or it's a very interesting functionality I've seen a lot. I bet it's vulnerable to XYZ.
You mentioned this is something that you are able to work with a lot.
Really?
is it because people are doing that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 sort of approach? Like they're not using a random number generator. Mm-hmm. Could people just easily fix this by just saying, hey, ID equals random number generator, and then boom. And then that would stop like most of your exploits in that area.
Well, I'd say they still should validate that the ID is owned by the person making the call, but it reduces the likelihood of exploitation like by a bunch. Because let's use that hypothetical example. We've got an application that lets you write documents, and the documents are just a guessable ID. And let's say I found a way to delete other people's documents by just using their ID. Well, because it's a guessable ID, I can just like write a script that, you know, iterates from 00001 all the way to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then just put it on repeat, and then boom, I've deleted every single document in the entire application, right? Whereas if the vulnerability still exists, like it still doesn't validate, but the ID is unguessable, then it puts the onus on the attacker to, okay, try to like either fish out that ID using like phishing attacks, or find it like on like the web archives. If you go to like, you know, with the Wayback Machine and try to find some like reference online or some like Google Doc or something that might give you an idea as to what that ID is. In which case it's still vulnerable, but it's not vulnerable in the sense that a user could delete every single document in the application.
Got it. In that example of like deleting stuff, I think that is definitely from a bug bounty perspective makes a lot of sense. From a bad hacker perspective, like, I mean, okay, they delete everything. Yes, that hurts my user experience. That sucks. But at least they're not, they're not getting data, right? They're not being able to use that data in a different way. I'm assuming what you mean by that, though, is if they change the API, if they can guess that ID, they can change the API to the point where maybe they can even like put in some malignant code that then can trigger other stuff. Is that correct?
Well, so I mean, I just use delete as an example. Like, what if instead it was a GET request could retrieve every document in the application, and then like say it's an application as big as like, you know, Google Drive. If Google Docs or Google Drive was using just guessable IDs, and then a bad hacker could, instead of deleting every document in the application, could like retrieve every document in the application, and maybe those documents are like health records, or maybe those documents are like, it's like got financial information, or maybe instead the bug is a vulnerable put request where you could modify documents. Then okay, from a bad hacker perspective, you can like overwrite financial data. So that's kind of, it kind of just is depends on the bug.
Yeah.
So as a bad attacker, even as a malicious attacker, like I would be thrilled to find, you know, anything that let me either like get or delete or modify data.
Okay. How often are you finding the stuff where and I'm guessing this is not that often because it's the bug bounties, but you know, you hear these attacks where literally it'll be just like there's a plain text file that someone just found, and then it's just like, oh, okay, nothing's encrypted. Like it was pretty easy. Like as long as you can read, you basically were able to exploit this. Like maybe in these bug bounty environments, that's not as common, but I just wanted to ask that question. Like, how are you seeing them?
Oh, no, that's totally common. Yeah. 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 So like looking for secrets is totally an aspect of bug bounty. A very common tactic bug bounty hunters will be going to that company's like GitHub organization, and then like just scanning the repos, looking for like API keys that give them access to, you know, whatever data they is hosted on whatever service is using that API key. Or maybe there's like Google Docs links, you know, just like hard coded into repositories where it's like, okay, you know, maybe it was like put in a code comment saying, you know, here's a link to our team Zoom recording meeting or something, you know? And so that's just like looking through GitHub. Maybe there's an endpoint in the body of the data that's returned is like some API key. So you got to be looking for the request responses to see, is there vulnerable like or sensitive information in the response that shouldn't actually be there? You know, so there's doing like recon and like automation is how a lot of bug bounty hunters make a lot of money, because they just look for things that are exposed that shouldn't be exposed, and maybe in like they're exposed in a kind of place you wouldn't expect. Like, you know, a normal user isn't going to be going and looking through a GitHub repo that's 7 years old, but an attacker sure is,
right?
Especially if they find something that like is super sensitive.
It's just, even when you were talking about like the comments and stuff, it's just like, oh, you know, you just did that really quickly because you need to,
yeah,
you know, and all of a sudden, yeah.
So one of my favorite things is when a hacker will find, like, go through a company's like documentation or like support portal, and they'll be like, docs and how to use the application. And it'll have some video of like an education person, you know, using the application in a certain way. Like maybe there's a video, like a tutorial on the company's doc site to like, here's how to use XYZ feature. But then, and it might like have a, like an API key, like in the video. And if they were using like an actual like production organization and didn't rotate that key, like I've seen hackers use videos or like screenshots in documentation to gain access to things because yeah, whoever was like writing the docs, you know, they're typically not like super like security thoughtful people. They're just writing docs to make their users have a better experience learning the application. But, you know, they're not thinking, okay, who is actually watching this? Who is seeing this? And what am I actually showing? You know, maybe my cursor is over here on the right side of the screen, but over on the left side of a screen in a window behind the primary window, but you can still see there's like a little like API key there. It's like, oh, there we go. And so those are super fun bugs to find. Yeah.
It's crazy how you guys are, hackers must be really good at the Easter egg hunt, right? Like,
you know, so for real. In fact, that's why there's such a big crossover between like capture the flags and bug bounty hunting, because, you know, we like being able to just creatively find solutions to problems that go under the nose of the average user.
Yeah. The last thing I want to do on hacking, and then I want to kind of move into like the AI aspect, the topic du jour, just because I think there's some interesting things. But what security products, like even if you were just thinking about from an access side, and you don't need to name company names or something, I'm going to name, like, you know, I don't know, Auth0 or something like that, or Okta or something. But even if you don't, is there certain categories of security products or something that are extremely challenging? Like, if they have an XDR product, it's going to be really tough for us to get in. Or if they have, you know, like, I don't know if there is some sort of a classification like that you have, but I'm just curious if there is anything.
So there are security products that get put in place that I think make my job more annoying, but that, when you zoom out, wouldn't stop a very determined attacker. So for example, I'll take like a WAF, you know, web application firewall. It might be like, you know, stopping requests. Like if you try to do like an XSS and like put in like weird like script tags and whatnot, it might be like, this is blocked. And it's like, okay, fine. And it will make me like have to go through the steps of like bypassing the WAF, which is possible. Like WAFs are almost always bypassable, right? You know, you just have to like look for the IP address of the application that's actually running the app, and then just go basically backdoor into the same application to get past the WAF. And so they're annoying. Like MFA is kind of the same way, but I'd say within the context of bug bounty, because our target is finding vulnerabilities in like the application, I think security products are typically geared towards preventing like attackers from gaining access into your network or getting access to systems that they don't control. Whereas as a bug bounty hunter, I don't care if I'm caught, because my goal is to just find vulnerabilities and then report them.
Right.
And so I'd say I don't interface so much with security products, aside from things like WAFs, which just kind of make me roll my eyes and just make my job
slightly harder. Yeah.
Yeah. It's frustrating, because like my job is to help the customer out. And WAFs are like almost always bypassable. And so I'm like, could you just like, don't make me go through like walk an extra mile just to do what I'm trying to like.
What I'm going to do anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm like, can you just like turn it off for me so that I can find like actual vulnerabilities and not make like this a painful experience? But yeah.
Well, it sounds like we just need to make WAFs that aren't as easily bypassable. But but let's move into the AI side of things. So, I mean, how have you started incorporating AI into your ethical hacking?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're still in the super early days of AI. I'd say I haven't gotten to the point where I have like built out like hack bots to do my work for me. However, I have used, I'm using these a lot more often, is using language models to help think about creative solutions to areas where I might be stumped. Like maybe I'm encountering an application that's, yeah, I'm really close to a bug, but there's like a couple of like snags in the way. I might like tell the language model or the AI about this application, like what the features are, what the functionality is, and be like, here's what I've got. Help me take it. Like, help me take it all the way. Is there something I'm not thinking of? And that's, at least for me, that's kind of where AI has been helpful, as less of a bot and more as a sounding board and a hacking buddy.
Is it giving you code to run, or is it literally just helping you think through, like, hey, there's this scenario?
No, it can give me code to run. Like, maybe I'm so for example, maybe I found a CSERP vulnerability, and I can go into what those are if you need. But I'm like, I need to generate a proof of concept to demonstrate to the program. Here's the request that's vulnerable. Can you just generate a CSERP like proof of concept for me, so I don't have to like try to like write some weird HTML blob that'll show the actual impact. I can just have ChatGPT or whatever language model do that for me. Or maybe I need help writing trying out a couple of like cross-site scripting payloads. I can have an AI help me there. Or maybe I need to run a web service to be able to exploit some type of vulnerability. I can have the AI like generate me a simple like web app. It definitely has like technical capabilities of like writing code or scripts or web applications, which are helpful.
If you dream in the future, do you think that, you know, I'm just making it up, 5 years from now, you will be spending some time so-called coding some of those hacking bots to mm-hmm. like learn a specific application, then just go and be like, hey, now your team is effectively you
yeah.
and, you know, hacking bot one and hacking bot two?
Yeah, I mean, if not me, then somebody else. I think like either it's going to be something that hackers are writing themselves, you know, hacking bots that are just like open source and hackers can use anyways, or there's going to be some like product or company that makes hacking bots for hackers and for security teams. And, you know, we're just customers of theirs and just using their hacking bots. But yeah, it's absolutely heading in that direction.
Okay, got it. Just before we wrap things up, like, you do a lot of these bug bounties. You've been a security engineer at many different companies. What's the most common security advice that you find yourself giving to teams over and over again?
This is advice I give less as a security engineer to my security teams, and more advice I give as a bug bounty hunter to the companies that I'm hacking on. And it's that, like, I'm not your adversary. I'm working with you. I think there's a lot of like stigma and shame that kind of comes with having to like pay a bug bounty hunter money for a bug, because it's like, you know, we gotcha. Now give me your money. You know, and it's not like that at all. Like, the way you have to think about bug bounty is that when you pay out a bounty, you aren't like being dinged a fine. You are purchasing a bug from the hacker. Like those bugs exist. Like, they exist before the hacker even touched the application. You are paying the hacker to provide you bugs, which, you know, maybe your own security team hasn't found yet, or that you haven't been able to allocate resources to finding. And so there really needs to be a brotherly or a sisterly or just some type of camaraderie relationship between bug bounty hunters and security teams, because that's the only way it's going to work, right? Like, hackers don't want to work with teams who are super standoffish and aggressive and fight you when you try to like report a vulnerability. And similarly, security teams don't want to deal with hackers that are disgruntled and frustrated at, you know, not getting paid for their work. And so when there's like a really cohesive relationship and hackers are able to work together with a program to deliver high impact results, like that is where the real value is. In fact, that's where they'll find the best bugs. I think it was, I can't say the name of the customer, but I was working on a program last year, and they had dedicated engineers on their security team to help escalate the hacker's findings. So if I found something and I'm like, here's a bug, I've only got like about a medium impact, I think that I should be able to get it higher, but I'm kind of stuck, they would have security engineers called bar raisers work with the hackers to say, okay, here's what you got. I'll take my internal knowledge of our, you know, internal systems or our services or our products, and I'll see if I can't get more impact out of the bug that you already found.
Wow.
Whereas a lot of programs who aren't like that, and maybe who are less mature, would just be like, okay, thanks for the bug, you know, you reported it as a medium. That's all we're going to pay out as a medium, even though they know that there's probably more behind the scenes.
That's a fascinating approach. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything else you want to add on that, or
just to kind of like add on to like the value of a good relationship? Like some of the best experiences I've had on bug bounty programs are ones where I have like a direct line of communication to the program, and I can say, I'm working on your application. There's this really weird feature that just came out. It's in beta or it's in alpha. I don't quite understand it. I think this is a bug, but I need to like talk to somebody to figure out, is this actually a bug? The GitHub bug bounty program is like this. They're very easy to work with, and they have engineers who you can just like message on their bug bounty Slack, and they'll be able to answer any questions about the product and be able to tell you like, okay, you're close, but maybe take it this direction instead. And yeah, it's just, I've had an awesome time on that program because of the relationship aspect.
Well, this was just a fun conversation because I get the offensive excitement because there's just so much cool stuff to discover. And like you said, like, it's like, you know, it's like capture the flag or, you know, finding the Easter egg or whatever. It's, you get that, that dopamine rush of like, oh, I just figured this out. And now, you know, I can go move forward. So I, you know, this was a really fun conversation. Thanks for your time, Douglas. And I guess, like, is there anything that you'd like to say or highlight for the audience, on your side before we end?
If your listeners are at a company and they have a security team, but not a bug bounty program, like, I cannot highlight the value that a bug bounty program brings into your security team. Like, I've run two bug bounty programs myself, like on the defensive side, and we love our hackers. We love the findings that they bring, and our, you know, our security posture just wouldn't be the same without them. And as a hacker, I love working with awesome security teams. I mean, bug bounty has changed my life. I bought this house with bug bounty money. I bought my car and my wife's minivan with bug bounty money. Like, it's been life changing for me, and it's given my kids and, you know, opportunities that I would have never dreamed of having as a child. So, yeah, just being able to work with people who want to work with good hackers is, you know, why I'm doing this 5-6 years later after starting, and I don't see any signs of slowing down.
Well, hopefully we can find some more customers for you, Douglas, to help send the kids to Disney World. So
yeah, it'd be awesome.
Let's put that as a goal. But thanks so much.